ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, and welcome to the 2025 ABC Boyer Lectures. I'm Julia Baird, and this is the third in our five-part Boyer Lectures exploring Australia's radical experiment in democracy. In this lecture, the acclaimed Yuralarai Gamilaroi woman, writer, filmmaker, broadcaster and academic, Larissa Berendt, outlines the strengths of our legal systems, but she argues that a just society needs much more than sound courts. It needs more inclusive spaces for ideas in our universities and creative spaces for diverse perspectives to flourish. And she argues that embracing First Nations knowledge systems within our Western liberal traditions could significantly, even dramatically, strengthen our democracy. Over now to distinguished Professor Larissa Berendt from the Jumbunna Institute for Indigenous Education and Research at Sydney's University of Technology.
I would like to acknowledge country, wherever you are listening to these words, and pay respect to the elders who have kept culture and story strong. This protocol is an inclusive moment to reflect on 65,000 plus years of innovation, sustainability, creativity, and story. It reminds us that we are an old country, even if some people might describe Australia as a relatively new nation, and asks us not just to acknowledge the past, but to look to the future to ask ourselves, what is our role, what is our place in this ongoing story? I knew I wanted to become a lawyer as a teenager. As the daughter of an Aboriginal father and a mother who had to leave a job she loved in the armed services when she married, as was the rule of the time, I grew up in a household full of conversations and books that instilled in me a strong sense of what still needed to be done to improve society to make it fairer and just. But I also, as the first in family to go to university, deeply understood the opportunities. I was grateful for the advocacy of the Aboriginal rights and feminist movements of the generation before that had opened doors for me. I knew that what should be a right was a hard-fought-for privilege. I knew there was systemic injustice, which remains to this day, but I had the freedom to march in the street to protest, to write my opinions freely, and to use mechanisms such as petitions and even the courts to fight to change the things I felt were unjust. I want to reflect on what I have come to see through my own experience as both the illuminating strengths and the shadowed weaknesses of the Australian legal system and its role in our democracy. And as we see seismic geopolitical shifts, a rise in autocratic tendencies, and the erosion of democratic institutions in other countries that we would have assumed were far more robust, we need to be vigilant about sustaining and strengthening our democracy. The very institutions that sustain it, from our courts to our universities to our cultural spaces, are under sustained pressure. And without renewal and vigilance, the cracks in that foundation will widen. Our laws have shaped us, sometimes with protection and strength, sometimes with marginalisation, silence and harm. I want to reflect on how justice and fairness, if not found in the courts, can be found in other ways, and I want to point to a way forward. I was not naive when I undertook a law degree in the late 1980s to early 1990s. At the time, the current law of the country was still terra nullius. The High Court would hand down the Mabo case the year I was finishing law school, and by that time, my study of law had given me a deeper understanding of the role it had played in colonisation. It had justified the dispossession of Aboriginal people. It had continued to impose a structure that protected colonial land systems while ignoring Indigenous connections to country. It stood mute as Aboriginal people were massacred. It failed to protect the rights of parents and children to their families and their cultural heritage. It reinforced and made legal systems of segregation, discrimination, and exploitation. The law has never been neutral. It is a tool of the colonial project. But there are a lot of strengths in the Australian democratic system that we perhaps take for granted. One of the most important of these is that our judiciary remains independent, with a high court that has resisted the politicisation seen in other countries. The separation of powers is respected, and our electoral system, underpinned by compulsory voting, preferential voting, and an impartial electoral commission, ensures high participation and trust in the process. We change governments through ballots, not violence, a reminder that our democracy is stable, resilient, and still capable of renewal. There is much in our democracy to celebrate. And our legal system has, at times, risen to strengthen that democracy. The High Court, in cases such as the Roach case in 2007 and the Roe case in 2010, strengthened constitutional protections for the right to vote, affirming that participation in our democracy is not a privilege, but a constitutional safeguard. Through the treaty's power, international human rights norms have also been woven into Australian law, showing that our courts can open the door to global standards of fairness and dignity. These moments remind us that the law can be a powerful instrument for progress. But let's not be complacent, and let's not mistake stability for neutrality. The law is shaped by power. It reflects who has a voice and who does not. If we want a fairer society, we must ensure the law listens to those too often silenced, and we have to acknowledge that at the heart of the Constitution, there lies an historic and structural wound. When the Constitution was drafted, it was designed, after much discussion and debate, to provide the ability to create laws that were discriminatory on the basis of race. This decision was driven by the desire to make laws that would keep non-white migration to a minimum. The framers of our Constitution believed that decision-making about rights protections, which ones we recognise and the extent to which we protect them, were matters for the Parliament. They discussed the inclusion of rights within the Constitution itself, including a non-discrimination clause. But this option was rejected because a majority believed that entrenched rights provisions were unnecessary and that it was desirable to ensure that the Australian states would have the power to continue to enact laws that discriminated against people on the basis of their race. Section 25 of the Constitution is a window into the uncomfortable truth of what the framers thought was acceptable in 1901. It says that if a state disqualifies people from voting on the basis of race, those people are not to be counted when working out the state's population for the purpose of determining representation in the House of Representatives. Section 25 is one of the clearest textual indicators that, at Federation, Australia was comfortable with race-based exclusion as part of its constitutional design. In plainer terms, the Constitution assumes racial discrimination in voting could occur, and it accommodates it. The Constitution's inbuilt tolerance of racial discrimination was ameliorated somewhat in 1975 with the passage into law of the Racial Discrimination Act, now celebrating its 50th year. It is complemented by anti-discrimination legislation at the state and territory level, which also prohibits discrimination on the basis of race in key areas, including, importantly, in the workplace and in the provision of services. The Racial Discrimination Act has been a cornerstone in advancing equality before the law, and its power has been tested and upheld in landmark cases. In Kawada and Bjelke-Petersen in 1982, the High Court confirmed that the Racial Discrimination Act, grounded in Australia's international human rights obligations, could strike down state policies that discriminated on the basis of race, reinforcing that racial equality is a national legal standard, not a local preference. In Mabo and Queensland No. 1 in 1988, the Racial Discrimination Act was again pivotal, invalidating a Queensland law designed to extinguish the native title claims of the Miriam people, ensuring their case could proceed to the landmark decision in 1992. The Racial Discrimination Act is not symbolic. It has real legal force, capable of overriding discriminatory laws. But what the Parliament gives, the Parliament can take away. And here is where the original ideologies underpinning the Constitution still come into play. When Njarrindjeri women sought to protect sacred cultural knowledge from being destroyed by a bridge, the Howard government repealed the heritage protection legislation that would have given them a mechanism to challenge the development. In order to do this, the Racial Discrimination Act had to also be suspended. In the 1998 case of Kartnyeri and the Commonwealth, the Hindmarsh Island Bridge case, the High Court ruled that Parliament could validly repeal the Racial Discrimination Act to remove its protections. Our federal Parliament can override statutory rights at its will. It was a stark reminder that in Australia, even hard-won legal safeguards are fragile, and that without constitutional protection, the rights of vulnerable communities remain at the mercy of political tides. The Racial Discrimination Act has been suspended in two other instances. In 1998, to allow for the implementation of the Howard government amendments to the native title legislation that implemented its 10-point plan to impose a series of limitations on native title rights. And in 2007, to permit the mechanisms that the Howard government was seeking to introduce in the Northern Territory intervention, which included sweeping measures on Aboriginal communities, including compulsory income management, compulsory acquisition of land leases, and the dismantling of community governance and programs. Now widely considered to be an abject policy failure, its legacy is being seen in the Northern Territory today, with increased incarceration rates, high suicide rates, and poor educational outcomes. As a rule of thumb, if the government is seeking to repeal the Racial Discrimination Act, it's probably doing something that is racially discriminatory. Given the structural legacy of racism in the Australian Constitution and the contemporary experience with the vulnerability of statutory protections against racial discrimination, it is little wonder that the issue of constitutional recognition and a change that goes beyond something merely symbolic has long been a part of the political agenda for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But with the resounding no in the 2023 referendum, I would predict that much like the issue of the Republic, which was defeated in a referendum in 1999, despite majority community support, we are unlikely to see the political will to revisit the issue in the next generation. I recognise and understand, and at times have felt, the deep hurt caused to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people by the racism that surfaced during the referendum campaign. But it is important not to conflate that painful experience with the outcome of the vote itself. The rejection of a constitutional change was not a rejection of First Nations people. Attempts to read the result of the 2023 referendum as more than simply a rejection of a change to the Constitution are mischievous. Australians have been reluctant to amend the Constitution. There have now been 45 attempts to do so, and only 8 have been successful. And support for reconciliation is strong. Polling consistently shows that Australians support reconciliation, even if they are divided on how to achieve it. The 2024 Australian Reconciliation Barometer showed that 85% of Australians believe the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians is important. I stress that recognition in the Constitution is not the same as undoing its structural racial discrimination, but it should be seen as part of a political project that understands that there is still a racial bias within the Constitution that needs to be addressed. My assertion is that, based on the ideological underpinnings of the framers and the choices they made to allow racially discriminatory legislation, we have a constitution, a founding document, that today still permits racial discrimination, only prevented by the Racial Discrimination Act to the extent that it provides a shield. And what we have seen are governments willing to suspend those baseline protections. One of the hardest barriers in fighting for a greater protection of rights is the misconception that the granting of rights to one sector of the community deprives another of it. Rights are not a zero-sum game. But First Nations rights are often painted that way. If we give you native title, I will lose my backyard. If I give you a greater say about the things that affect you, a voice, my rights to tell you how to live your life will be diminished. But this is a harmful fallacy. When a right is protected, due process before the law, equality before the law, protection from racism in the workplace, it applies to everyone. It lifts everyone up, especially those who are most vulnerable and need protection the most. In a similar way, a more inclusive history is not an us and them. Recognising the truth of our past does not diminish non-Indigenous Australians. It deepens our shared history. This is a colonised country, and no country that has experienced colonisation escapes its darker legacies. Colonisation is designed to erase the colonised and privilege the coloniser. An honest, inclusive national story is the antidote and provides a richer, inclusive national identity. This harmful us and them mentality is an inhibitor to a stronger, more cohesive society, and its ability to divide us is a threat to our democracy. So, what can we do? Well, first consider a legislative bill of rights. Australia remains the only liberal democracy without a national bill of rights, and the absence of such a framework leaves our protections piecemeal and more vulnerable to political whim. A stronger rights culture would not only safeguard freedom of expression, equality, and due process, but also provide a shared foundation for addressing the inequalities that persist in our society. That rights culture might start to erode an us and them mentality. A Bill of Rights would place human dignity at the heart of our legal system and ensure that the values we claim to uphold are given real, enforceable substance. Secondly, we need to see the process of truth-telling as a nation-building project. Truth-telling about our past is not about blame. It is about honesty. By acknowledging the full story of colonisation, its harms as well as its resilience, we create the foundation for a future that is stronger and more inclusive. When all Australians can see themselves in a shared narrative, built on respect rather than denial, we open the door to a more just and unified nation. Thirdly, we need to build our social cohesion through the power of storytelling. Telling stories is a powerful strategy for achieving social justice because it shifts issues from the abstract to the human. From statistics to lived experience, facts and policy arguments may inform, but stories engage the heart, making the realities of injustice tangible and relatable. They allow people to see the world through another's eyes, breaking down stereotypes, prejudice, and apathy. Storytelling also reclaims agency. For communities who have been silenced, telling their own stories counts as attempts at erasure and at the same time asserts identity, culture, and truth on their own terms. Narratives can mobilise empathy into action, build solidarity across divides, and influence public opinion in ways that can pressure institutions to change. In legal, political, and cultural movements, from Mabo to Me Too, stories have reframed debates, inspired allies, and made justice feel both urgent and possible. Today, our universities and our arts are under constant attack and relentless pressure, too often dismissed or derided and eroded by funding cuts. Yet I believe in the central role our creative industries, cultural institutions, art sector, humanities, and social sciences play in a healthy democracy. These are the spaces where we wrestle with big themes, challenge our prejudices, foster conversations that build cohesion, and express our identities and experiences. They are vital sites for the transfer of knowledge. As changing technologies present both opportunities and risks, we must protect and revitalise our universities, libraries, and cultural institutions, not as luxuries, but as foundations. Finally, we have to value, be curious about, and build on our ancient wisdoms. One of the most hurtful aspects of the debate around the 2023 referendum was the re-emergence of the tired and insulting narrative that Aboriginal people are somehow stone-aged. What is so often missing is curiosity about how we became and remain the world's oldest continuous culture, a legacy of knowledge, resilience, and innovation that should be a source of national pride. You do not get to be considered the world's oldest living continuous culture by luck. For tens of thousands of years, Aboriginal people lived on this continent sustainably and adjusting to change. But to me, that's not even the most wondrous part of what my culture today represents. As I see my Yuwalari community come together, learning our language, connecting with country, claiming our native title, regenerating our cultural practices, I marvel not just that my culture has survived 65,000 plus years, but that it has survived everything that colonisation has thrown at us over the last couple of centuries. Surely there is strength and resilience in that, which should inspire us to help find solutions to the challenges we are collectively facing today, including climate change and threats to our democracy. Indigenous knowledge systems are not simply cultural artefacts. They are sophisticated intellectual traditions. They offer ways of thinking rooted in sustainability, reciprocity, interconnection, and care for country. They value the wisdom of male and female elders, lived experience, and collective problem solving. Imagine if these philosophies were centred in how we govern, educate, and respond to crisis. Our debates about democracy have too often been confined to the narrow horizons of European thought, framed by the philosophies of French and British men from a few centuries ago. That lineage has given us important ideals, but it has also limited our imagination. What if, instead, we went further back? What if we drew on the oldest continuing cultures in the world, on First Nations knowledge systems that value consensus, responsibility to community, and deep care for country? Including First Nations worldviews would not just enrich our democracy, it would transform it, broadening it beyond the confines of Western liberal traditions and grounding it in values of respect, reciprocity, and shared survival. This is the conversation that could carry our democracy into a more inclusive and enduring future. The concept of interdependence reminds us that no nation, no community, and no individual can face the climate crisis alone. It asks us to see our connections to each other, to the natural world, and to the generations that will follow, not as vulnerabilities, but as sources of strength. Interdependence shifts our focus from short-term, self-interested decision-making to shared responsibility and mutual benefit. It is a philosophy long embedded in First Nations knowledge systems, where care for country is inseparable from care for people. Embracing interdependence means sharing technology, pooling resources, and acting collectively across borders. It means recognizing that our resilience is measured not by how well the most powerful adapt, but by how well we protect the most vulnerable. In an era of climate disruption, interdependence is not a sentimental ideal. It is a survival strategy. Interdependence strengthens democracy. It reminds us that our rights and freedoms are sustained not in isolation, but through the web of relationships we share with others. It calls us to see our fellow citizens not as competitors for scarce resources, but as partners in shaping a fair and cohesive society. When we act with an understanding of interdependence, we value dialogue over division, collaboration over confrontation. We recognise that the health of our democracy depends on trust. Trust that our institutions will act with integrity, and trust that we will extend care and respect across our differences. Interdependence fosters a civic culture where listening is as important as speaking, where compromise is not weakness but wisdom, and where the well-being of each of us is bound to the well-being of all. A just society does not scapegoat the vulnerable. It lifts them, it listens to them, it learns from them. Multiculturalism has brought cultural richness and economic strength. Inclusion has never weakened a society, it has always made it stronger. While permission for racial discrimination still sits within our constitution, it is even more important that we ensure our civil society is strong, just, and inclusive. In a time of increasing geopolitical divisions, we need to value, nurture, and fiercely protect inclusivity and social cohesion. As the divide between rich and poor, especially in relation to intergenerational wealth, continues to feel more pronounced, we need to strongly embrace the values of equality and fairness. We need to celebrate the strengths of our democratic institutions, including our legal system, but we need to continue to increase both its inclusivity and its resilience. The future of Australian democracy lies not just in its courts, but in its classrooms, its cultural institutions, its stories, its creative practices, and its courage to imagine. If we invest in justice and imagination, we invest in a democracy that will outlast us all.
That was our third Boyer lecturer, Larissa Berendt. And as an added bonus to this year's Boyers, I spoke to Larissa just after she gave her lecture.
Now, our first lecturer in the series, Professor Justin Wolfers, gave the case for Australia as a very robust democracy with strong institutions that have made us prosperous. And he had one important caveat there. He said, none of this has worked well for the first Australians, and that's a stain on our democracy. Now, what is the best way to measure the health of a democracy?
Look, I guess one of the things I explored in my lecture was I do think there are things in our democracy that are robust and we shouldn't take them for granted. Mm. I think they're probably more vulnerable than we, you know, than we perhaps like to admit or assume sometimes.
And the legal system, an important part of that.
Yeah, and electoral system, etc. These are really important things. But I think it's also important to stress that when we're looking at a democracy, we shouldn't look at how well it's working for those who are well off and advantaged. The real test always has to be, how are our institutions working for those who are the most vulnerable? How are they working for the most marginalised? How are they working for people who are often othered in our society? A really robust democracy has to treat that part of our society as carefully as other people are treated in it. So for me, I think it's important not so much to say, yes, everything's great, but we've still got some issues we could do better on. I think it's more important that we think more centrally, where are those vulnerabilities? And let's make that the central focus on how we're testing how well our democracy is going.
And you've argued that really built into our democratic framework and the Constitution was an ability for people to racially discriminate, and that's a wound at the heart of it, essentially. So what has that meant for us functioning as a democratic government, a democratic society?
So I think what's important to think about is we'll often look at the Constitution. It's a document that sets up our system of governance, and in many ways it's quite dry. I have lots of friends who are constitutional lawyers who always encourage more people to read it, but it is a very dry document, and it sort of has a very utile purpose of setting things up. So you can fall into a false trap of thinking that actually it's quite neutral on these issues.
Right.
Section 25 is a really good example because it's probably one of the places where you see that racial discrimination intention playing out so graphically in an area that we would easily say, well, that would never happen today. You cannot imagine that we would deprive anyone of the right to vote on the basis of their race. And in fact, I think the High Court would find that unconstitutional given other interpretations it's had. So I think what you need to be really mindful of is that those things sit in there. And we have seen contemporary examples that show that vulnerability. But for me, I guess the heart of what I'm trying to argue is if we understand that those philosophies and ideologies that were so prevalent in 1901 but still imbue the document today, we have to be even more vigilant in how we have discussions and find place within our civil society to make sure that we're not just relying on the law to be the curer of what equality means. We need to be thinking about what is cohesion, what is inclusion in these other spaces like our universities, our cultural institutions.
When we think about the idea of social democracy, do governments, democratic governments respond to their citizens? Do they feel well represented? Are they, acting on behalf of the people? And you also call in your lecture for truth-telling, for a fuller account of our history, a deeper account of our history. How does that relate to the way a government relates to its people?
Well, I guess what I see is I first of all think that as a colonised country, we need to ensure that we have a truthful account of our history.
Yep.
It's not the case that's not always been the case. And in fact, I think we're doing the Boyer lectures now, and probably Stanner in his Boyer lecture called that out specifically when he talked about the Great Australian Silence. There was a way in which these narratives were hidden. A lot of work's been done since then, both by historians and by Aboriginal communities to continue to try and tell their truth.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be honest that there is a part of our history that needs to be acknowledged. What I object to is the idea that this is an us and them. I actually believe that we build a more socially cohesive community the more we see broad voices included in our national narratives, and not just First Nations people. The migrant experience, the many diasporas that now richly make Australia their home should be part of our national story. So I think we need to challenge this idea that truth-telling is somehow an us and them activity. I see it as a nation-building activity.
And what about those people who say we need to be more positive when we talk about Australia's past, that children today are given a negative perspective of Australia's history?
I don't see that, and perhaps that's because I grew up exposed to both cultures. And as somebody who is very aware of all of the negative impacts of colonisation, when I talk about stories from my community, I never think of them in a deficit model. I see stories of resilience, I see stories of strength, I see stories of generosity, and I see stories of hope. I see stories that make me laugh. In the Aboriginal community, there are stories that shouldn't confront people as though hearing those stories will somehow make them feel negatively about themselves. I think the more that we engage with the stories that people have to tell us about their experience, the more we can feel wonder, the more we can feel connected to them. I really feel like this, that the idea that somehow we're not positive about our past is really just code for saying we can't talk about the bad things. But what I would say is when we talk about the impacts of colonisation, we can also celebrate resilience, we can celebrate humour, we can celebrate amazing stories of survival. I would like to see those as being stories that all Australians feel that they should be proud of.
Mm. You also talk about how often the debates around democracy are framed in terms of, you know, white Western philosophers over the past few centuries. Now, and you suggest we go back further to ancient wisdoms of our longest continuing living cultures here. What would it look like? What would our democracy look like if we brought in and properly understood and valued ideas like interdependence, which you talk about?
Yes, I guess for me what my thoughts were that I wanted to share is that I think that there are values within First Nations cultures and in other cultures outside of the Western tradition that have values that have been sustaining over time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't get to be the world's oldest living culture just by being able to live with the environment. Of course, you need to be able to do that. But you also need to be able to live with each other. And it's always been a source of curiosity for me that other Australians, non-Indigenous Australians particularly, aren't more interested in why that is. What is it about the way that we see the world that has allowed that sustainability? And for me, the heart of that are these principles of interconnectedness, which is totally through our totemic systems. Through those systems, we're related to each other, we're related to the natural world, we're related to our ancestors, we're related to our descendants. It's such a different way of thinking about how society works. And you can see with the fracturing of our community, the way that there's sort of a feeling that social cohesion is falling apart, that these ideas are things that might imbue us with a different way of thinking about how we're related to each other, getting over that us and them mentality. And I don't have a simple answer for what that might look like, and nor is it up for me to prescribe that. What I would like to see is in these spaces of creativity, in our cultural institutions, in our humanities and social sciences, in our creative practices, these are the places where we can explore what that should be. This should be deciding what that looks like or how that might change Australian democracy should be a society-wide project. Mm. And my claim is that in the very places where that discussion could take place, we actually see a further encroachment on things that keep a democracy strong.
Larissa Berendt, Distinguished Professor from the John Bunner Institute for Indigenous Education and Research at Sydney's University of Technology. And you can re-listen to this Boyer lecture at the ABC Listen app or watch it via ABC iView. Next week's Boyer lecturer is Amelia Lester, a deputy editor at Foreign Policy magazine in Washington. She explores the looming seismic upheaval in all of our lives, which is artificial intelligence, and what it might mean for Australian democracy. I'm Julia Baird. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.